At this time, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the month of May. Joanne is very near and dear to my immediate AA family. She comes to us from Coopersburg, Pennsylvania. And without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Joanne Fee, who will be sharing with us her personal story and her experience, strength, and hope on steps 1 and 2.
My name is Joanne, and I am an alcoholic, and I'm really happy to be here, and I'm extremely happy to be sober today. I just thought popped into my head. I was speaking with my boyfriend's uncle the other night, and this Saturday we're going to his daughter's graduation in Penn State, and that's going to be my 8-year anniversary that day. So I'm trying to plot and plan on, you know, what meeting I'm going to go to, because, of course, you know, I want to go to a meeting that day somewhere. Last year I was in Western Pennsylvania, and Barry looked at me and he said, because I said, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic, and this weekend I'll be celebrating 8 years. You know, I'll be celebrating 8-year anniversary of, you know, being sober. And he said to me, boy, it must be really hard, huh? And I said to him, no, it's a joy. You know, and I couldn't imagine still being a slave to alcohol. And this life to me, as it is today, is so much better than anything I could have possibly imagined when, before I came here, before you came and got me. Alcoholics Anonymous came and got me. I didn't come to you, you know. This, you know, was revealed to me very recently. You know, I started thinking about it, you know, because I hear so many speakers talk about, you know, when I first walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and this and that. And I went to make amends to my ex-father-in-law. And I, this was in the last year. And it wasn't for any specific harm, but in thinking about our relationship and repeated inventories, it came to me that, you know, I really held him accountable for things that he wasn't capable of. You know, he did the best he could with what he knew and what he believes. And I was never able to make that leap over that bridge. I kept waiting for him to come to me. And I went to him and I spoke with him about this. And he was really, he's a man of God, as he understands him. And he started talking to me about his daughter. And his daughter went back into rehab again. She was due to go back in the day that I went to him to make the amend. And if that's not God working in someone's life, I don't know what it is. But, you know, it came to me, you know, she's the person who came and said she has been sober in AA for about 5 years, and I was still drinking, and her brother, my husband at the time, was still drinking. And we drank really well together. It's one of the things I found most attractive about him. And, you know, she, you know, arranged an intervention on him, and boy was I mad when I was not invited to this intervention, you know, because, you know, she saw me as part of the problem, of all things. And it took about another 10 months or so, but that was, it was as a result of that and her work, you know, her coming to get him and therefore me also, you know, because she just, you know, kind of offhandedly said, you know, you might want to think about this too. You know, and I saw how it worked in her life and what was happening for her. You know, she, like Evie, struggles with this, you know, and I don't know what it is, but she's due to get out of the rehab, and I'm going to give her a call because that's what her father asked me to do. So I'm looking forward to that. There's been a long period of reconstruction in my life. And I think that God works in our hearts at different times and at different in different ways, so that we can serve him best. You know, she came and got me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous came to get me, and I'm so glad you did. Let's see. I normally begin speaking with, you know, my name. My sponsor's name is Kathy. She's been my sponsor for quite a few years now. I also sponsor women, and it's really exciting for me to be a sponsor and also to have a sponsor. And, you know, I can look around the room and I see one of my stepsisters, as I call them, sitting here. I also encourage the women that I sponsor, I introduce them immediately to their stepsisters, as I call them. And it's exciting for me when I see them starting to sponsor other women. And this year at Kathy's anniversary, I came and brought one of her grandchildren, or whatever you want to call them, along, because I think that's important, you know, to see what happens, because this can grow geometrically, and that's how it has grown, is through sponsorship, you know, and us passing the message on as we learn it. And that's what's so important about this. And as, you know, Mike opens this meeting, you know, this is vital to my recovery. It's vital to my spiritual health to continue to pass this on. And as Jay was sharing before, Jay and I lost our jobs probably the same day, wasn't it? You know, I walked into Bernardsville and, you know, and I said to Mary Beth, oh, I lost my job today. And she goes, oh my God, so did Steph's boyfriend. And I went outside to commiserate with Steph. I didn't know Jay at the time. You know, he was just the boyfriend. And congratulations on finding a job. You know, I've heard two-fifth Steph's this spring, you know. It's been pretty busy. And for me, that's a great way to stay connected, you know. And to, you know, I look at these little breaks from, and I look at employment as sort of how God gets money flowing to me, you know. And it doesn't really matter what it is that I need to do as far as employment, as much as it is, you know, that I can serve other people. And I'm currently beginning a career that I think is a real good service for people. It's something I've never tried before. It's a big career change for me, and it's real exciting. So that's really cool. It's like we're on the same path a little bit, sort of, you know, parallel. So it was exciting to hear Jay's news tonight. But sponsoring other women and also doing other kinds of service. I chaired a meeting for about 9 months this past year, and I just finished that up at the end of April. I speak about every couple of weeks or so. I go out on a speaking commitment to a new meeting someplace I haven't been before. That seems to be the way it works out. I don't know how that happens. I spoke at a friend's anniversary two Fridays ago and set my anniversary date wrong. Good golly, I don't know what I was thinking. But it just came out wrong. Oh well, I'm not perfect. I go to a lot of meetings. I still go to a lot of meetings. I've always gone to a lot of meetings because I think that in the beginning, and I'll talk about this a little bit when we get to the second step, I have a real hard time, especially as a newcomer, sitting quietly and listening to God. And that's what meditation is. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't hear anything but the jabbering of my brain. And I would go to a meeting, and no matter, you know, it didn't matter what it was that I was going through that day, somebody would say something that had exactly to do with what I was going through. And I know that that's how God speaks to me still, through the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it works so well for me to be within a fellowship where there are so many people who are on this path with me. And we're all at different places. And one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous for me is the fact that nobody tells me what I have to believe, how I have to believe it, or what I need to do today, You know, I mean, there's steps that we need to follow if we want the results, but nobody says that you have to do them if you want to walk in this room. You know, a lot of the rooms that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can see that there's a lot of people who just aren't ready to work the steps for whatever reason, and the grace of God is keeping them sober at that point. And I know that that's what it is, because that's what happened for me. I guess I could talk a little bit about my drinking, since I have an hour. None of this, you know, I'll give you a little background on me so you can know a little bit about me. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My parents, Bill and Ruth, I was the third daughter. We lived in a little row house. I don't know if anybody's ever seen the movie Rocky. It was one of those little row houses, you know, and the little elevated train used to go by, you know, and you'd hear it rattling by. That's where I grew up. We then moved, you know, to a nice little split-level house shortly thereafter my father died. He was a teacher. My mom was at that point going to Temple trying to finish her degree, as I was the youngest daughter and I was now in school. My mother had gone back to school herself. And he died of leukemia. 15 months later, she died from complications from breast cancer. The three of us, by the protection of God, were kept together, my sisters. And we were taken into the home of my mother's oldest sister. And I was in third grade. My one sister was in sixth, and the other one was in ninth when this happened. So we were all taken, you know, off out of the city of Philadelphia to a suburb called, and the town is Flower Town. So if anybody ever asked me where I'm from, I'm from Flower Town, which is a very nice little town. I actually drove through it the other day because I happen to live, you know, maybe 40 minutes from it now. As a child, always did what I thought I was supposed to do. I pretty much followed the rules. I had a very normal childhood. Very, very, you know, as normal as could be. My sisters and I were together. We all went to a regular, you know, middle class, high school, you know, junior high, elementary, whatever. I did well scholastically, as did they. We all knew that it was expected that we would go to college. My aunt had taken what was left, you know, of the estate and put it in trust for us so that that would happen. And we lived basically on, you know, Social Security, whatever. And when I got into high school, I started experimenting with drugs. My first drink, I was 15 years old. I was on a church hayride. I was very involved with the church. My aunt and uncle made sure that all of us got, you know, went to church school, went to, you know, Sunday school, went to church. I was in the choir. I was in the youth group. I got confirmed at the right age, you know, when I was 13 with everybody else. And, you know, all these things happened in the order they were supposed to happen. And it wasn't until after I got sober that I realized that all of my childhood I lived in fear. And that was the fear that if I didn't do what I was told, I was going to get put out of that home. I recall hearing my aunt and my eldest sister, I'm going to say something that probably everybody can relate to, but the way my sister describes it, Leslie, if you ever hear this tape, excuse me, but it's, you know, we tell the truth here. And, you know, my aunt was going into menopause at the same time that my sister was hitting puberty, and it was a really bad combination. And, because nobody knew a whole lot about, you know, all the things that we know about today, so nobody had any explanation for all the emotional turmoil that was going on between the two of them, you know, being all of a sudden thrown together in this household. And they used to argue quite a bit. And because I think a lot of it had to do with also because when my father was ill and my mom was going to school and my mom was ill, my sister, Leslie, oldest sister, really became the parent, you know? And then all of a sudden we were in this home and, you know, she really, you know, had to abdicate that role, you know? And, you know, here it had always been her responsibility to take care of Gail and I, and it was just a mess. And I can, but anyway, back to me, I can recall them fighting and hearing my aunt say, you know, to my sister that if she didn't do what she was told to do, my aunt was going to put her in an orphanage. And being of an alcoholic mind, I never forgot that, you know, and it was always like kind of hanging over my head. And I think a lot of that for me is affected me in my spirit malady, because I was always a very wild child. I was always looking for the next best thing. I can remember when I was a child, always like running out of the house and, you know, running over to my friend's house, and their parents would be like, you know, it's like, because of course, you know, I didn't listen to my sisters. When she's like, you know, mommy said you had to be home, you have to stay home, you know, I'd be like, well, I didn't hear her, you know, and I keep going, you know. You know, and I was like five, you know. And I'd be out the door going to my girlfriend's house, you know, and I'd show up at her, and the mother would open the door and she'd be like, what are you doing here, Joanne? She can't come out and play now, it's dinner time. And I'd be like, oh, okay, you know. And even if my friends weren't there, I wouldn't go home because I had too much pride. I wouldn't admit, you know, that nobody was around, so I would just kind of hang out and do whatever, you know, and, I don't know, ride my bike around the block or whatever I did when I was five, you know. And, but, you know, I had, you know, that was like, the essence of my spirit malady was this always, like, running and looking, you know, and trying to find the next thing. And, you know, there was always something better, and it wasn't here, it was there, you know. And if it wasn't there, it was there, you know, and maybe it was there, you know. And I did a lot of running out. And I can remember after I did my fifth step the first time, the most powerful spiritual awakening that I had was a few days after my fifth step, sitting at home alone in my apartment, alone, mind you. Television wasn't on, stereo wasn't on. The neighbors were doing whatever they normally did, you know, and usually I would put, you know, blare everything to drown them out, and I was sitting home alone, sober, and it was okay, you know, and for me, that was just so huge, you know, that I could be okay, that I could just sit there and it was okay, I was okay with me, I could be calm and content, and not feel that, you know, restlessness and that need to, like, all of a sudden run out and do something, you know, like anything, you know, and just to be happy with that, you know, just to be with me, and that was okay. And I think that was one, like, that was so huge, you know. It's just, it's right, it's there in my heart. Let's see, I went to high school. I had my first drink when I was 15. I was out on a church hayride, and I threw up. You know, we drank rum and I threw up, you know. Well, you know, I didn't drink rum for a really long time after that. Until I discovered pina coladas, which was, you know, maybe 10 years later. But I still couldn't drink 151. It was just, you had to really disguise the rum for me to get it down. But that was my first drink. The next drink I can remember having, I was out with my boyfriend, and I was in college. I was out with my boyfriend, and we had gone to this really romantic place for dinner. And he, you know, it was white tablecloth restaurant, really nice little inn with a fireplace in the background, and it was winter time. And I was 17, and drinking age in Pennsylvania at that point was 21. So this was, like, really cool that we were at this restaurant and everything. And he ordered Drambuie, you know, with the coffee. And I thought that was, like, so grown up, you know. And I remember drinking it and just having that whole, it was the whole thing, you know. It was, like, it was romantic. I felt loved. I felt lovable. I felt content. I felt grown up. I felt like, you know, like Bill Wilson talks about, I had arrived, you know, like, this is the deal, You know, I could stand it going down, but I loved how it felt afterwards. And you know, for the first time, it filled up that hole inside me that I didn't even know I had. You know, I never even knew that hole was there until the booze filled it. You know, and for a long time, I used alcohol to treat that part of my disease. You know, alcohol treated my spirit malady because it fixed that. You know, I felt like I was okay, like I could be loved, you know, and that I was acceptable in the eyes of other people. And I still knew better than you. I knew I wasn't acceptable, but I could fool myself just a little bit. You know, I could cheat that. And that's what liquor did for me for a really, really long time. I did a lot of drugs. And I always drank. I loved going to frat parties. It cost you $1 to get in. And I usually had, like, you know, like the inside track on the frat parties because I used to go to all of them. So I knew a lot of the guys that were in the fraternities, some of them really well. And I knew which ones were going to have the biggest kegs, you know, or the most number of kegs. You know, like, oh, this one's having 16, that one's having 22, you know, whoever was going to have the most kegs, because I figured, well, then the beer's going to last until this hour, because I knew once I got started, I wasn't going to stop. You know, I was going to want to keep going, and I wanted there to be enough beer for me, you know, to drink myself into oblivion on my dollar. You know, and sometimes I didn't even have to pay, you know, because I knew one of the people at the door, so he'd be just like, oh, go ahead, John, you know. And so I did really well with the frat parties in college. However, I managed, you know. I did a lot of drugs. I did a lot of amphetamines to study because, of course, you know, I was missing a lot of classes. I wasn't doing my work until the very last minute. I pulled a lot of all-nighters. I smoked a ton of cigarettes. Good golly. I can remember sometimes at like 5 and 6 in the morning just like, my throat was absolutely raw. I had smoked like 2 packs of Marlboro Reds in, you know, like 12 hours or something. You know, it was just like one right after another. So I was like speeding a lot. And this combined with, you know, so then of course, you know, as soon as I got done whatever I had to do, then I deserved to have a drink, you know, go out to the bar and have a drink, you know, and enjoy myself with my friends because I deserved it, you know. I mean, hell, I got done what I had to do. And actually, I graduated college in 4 years with a double degree and a 3.0 average. And I know now, in retrospect, I was a full-blown alcoholic at that point. I can remember, you know, spring semester of my senior year rolling over, you know, and passing the bong to my roommate and saying, you know, I could never imagine waking up in the morning and not taking a hit first, you know. And then, you know, that was immediately followed with, you know, then going to the bar. You know, it was like whatever really was available, but it was always the booze. And when I turned, you know, when I got into my 20s, I started to notice that, you know, pot was making me paranoid. And I didn't like that so much, you know, so I stopped. And I can remember thinking from that point up until I actually voiced that opinion to my counselor in rehab, you know, booze was always dependable. I always knew where it was going to take me and what I had to do to get there, you know, wherever there was that day, you know, because sometimes I wasn't feeling so good, you know, I was feeling a little sad and I wanted to get, you know, a little happy, so that was a good reason to go out to the bar, you know. Sometimes I was really happy and I wanted to celebrate, so that was a good reason to go to the bar. You know, sometimes, you know, one of my friends was celebrating this or that or just happened to say, you know, meet me at the bar, and I said, okay, and that was a good reason to go to the bar. But, you know, and sometimes I just, you know, couldn't stand being in my own skin anymore, you know, because I started to think back on some of the things that I was doing that I wasn't really too proud of at this point. You know, I was an entrepreneur, shall we say, in the drug industry. there was a lot of guys that, you know, you know, they kind of all got like lumped into this one little category on the fourth step as the frat boys, you know. I don't remember their names, you know. And then it was like, oh my God, you know, like, what if I see that person on campus, you know? And it was, you know, of course it was like the first time that, you know, that happened, you know, where I slept with somebody and then the next day I saw them and they just like didn't even say hello. And there was that sick feeling inside of, oh my God, how awful is that? You know, and of course, I didn't think, how awful is he? I thought, oh my God, how bad am I? You know, I took that in, you know, and I find when I work with other women, that's a pretty common feeling that women have, you know, when that kind of thing happens. Because for me, it goes back to that, you know, I'm just not lovable. You know, I'm not acceptable. And that's part of my spirit malady, you know. And I realized pretty early on that once I started to drink, I had to be sure that there was going to be enough. Now, the question was, how much was going to be enough? You know, it was really cool when I got my own apartment, because then I could make sure that, you know, I had it at home. You know, this was a little bit more difficult when I was on campus in a state where I was underage until the middle of my senior year. Up until that point, I had to, you know, find other people to procure the stuff for me. So, you know, this was the difficulty, you know, in finding people who were over 21 to, you know, buy me what I wanted. So it kind of made me, in a way, a sporadic drinker. I had, you know, false ID, though, so I could always get into the bars. And, you know, once you start frequenting the bars, after a while, they just kind of assume that you're the right age. I'll tell my, when I turned 21, I was home, I was in Flower Town, and I was out with a friend of mine, and I was on, I had decided that night, because here I had graduated, you know, I wasn't just a beer drinker, I was grown up now, and I had started drinking martinis. I drank Beefeater gin, martinis straight up with a twist, and on my 21st birthday, I decided I was going to drink 21 of them. To me, today I look back and I see that that's the mental obsession, you know. Now, what happened is, you know, we went to this bar that I had been in many times before, and the bartender said, oh, Joanne, what are you here for? You know, and my friend Rick said, you know, oh, we're celebrating her birthday, and the bartender said, how old are you? And I said, 21. And he said, well, I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, because, you know, obviously it was news to him. So what happened was I drank the 21 martinis and the bar wasn't closed yet, and so I drank two more. Okay, now to me, I think that that's pretty clearly the phenomenon of craving, because that's a lot of booze, you know. There's a couple of shots in each martini, you know. Now what happened was the bar closed eventually, and after I had these two more, and my friend said, well, I know, you know, this guy's having has a keg over his house. He's having a little party. Let's go over there. So we went over there. And we got over there, and we helped him finish off the keg. So we started to leave. You know, at this point, there's a lot of parts of this that I don't remember. I had a lot of blackout problems. And brownout problems in my drinking, you know, where like parts would be missing and then I'd come to again, sort of, you know. I have another good story about that. I'll get to that in a minute. And what happened was, you know, we got into his car and he was going to take me home, and it was January and there was snow on the ground. And I said, wait a minute, you're going to have to pull over. And I threw up in the snow. I got out of the car and I threw up in the snow. And the next day, I slept pretty much 24 hours around. I guess there was, you know, some sedative in my system or something, you know. And you know, I can remember waking up and I had this awful hangover, and I just thought to myself, I remembered getting sick the night before, and I thought to myself, well, that's it. I'm not drinking beer on top of martinis anymore. Now, for me, you know, that's kind of like the mental obsession, too, because for that continued for like another 15 years, where I tried 15 to 17 years, I tried different ways to control my drinking, you know, and one of them was to watch what I mixed, you know, because I noticed certain things made me sick. You know, I stopped drinking beer after a while because I just got bloated and you had to go to the bathroom a lot. And then, you know, and it was just like, you know, like, why even bother, you know? But I liked wine, you know, and wine seemed to take longer for me to get, you know, into that brownout stage. I usually remembered things that occurred, you know, especially once I got married and my husband had his own business and we entertained a lot. And so it was important that I be able to function and, you know, like, serve dinner, clear dinner, hold a nice conversation with the clients, you know, all that kind of stuff, and kind of remember it later because I might see them again. And so it was, you know, so that's, I did a lot of that in that period, was drinking wine and that kind of thing. For me, I was thinking of another story. There were periods in my life when I could stop drinking completely. One of them was when I had gotten out of college and I had gotten a job in my field, and I was working at it for 6 or 7 years, and someone suggested to me that I would probably be really good at this, you know, these new computer things. This was 18 years ago, so, you know, this was going back quite a ways, and that was my first career change. What happened was I continued working at my full-time job because I was single, self-supporting. That's what I had to do. And I went to school at night, and I took 2 courses, which took up 4 nights of the week, and the rest of the time I had to spend in the data center. So I was like virtually busy all the time. I didn't have time to drink. And there was about 6 months where I didn't drink. I thought about drinking, you know, but I just couldn't fit it into my schedule. And during that period of time, because I had a different mental obsession, and I hear this also with a lot of women, you know, given sufficient reason, we can stop for a while. You know, whether it's a career, and that career might be the family. You know, for me, it was this change of careers and going back to school, you know, needing to support myself and wanting to get into this other industry, which turned out to be a very profitable decision for me over the course of my life. And so I was able to stop. Now, after I got a job in that industry, that following weekend, after I had started that job, celebrate. And I was living with a roommate who I now look back and say was a binge drinker, because she would, you know, be sober all week, and then on the weekends she would buy like a fifth of vodka and just drink the whole thing, just like go in her room and drink the whole thing. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, I was just like, oh, okay, so that's how she drinks. You know, and it just, you know, didn't occur to me that there was anything, you know, strange about that, because at that point in my life, I had experienced a lot of different ways of changing our consciousness using chemicals. So anybody's bag was whatever they wanted to do. So I was pretty accepting of that. And she bought her bottle of vodka. I bought my bottle of vodka. And after about, like, so you say a bottle of vodka, it was probably a quart. And I drank about this much of it, okay? And then I must have gone into a blackout, because I came to and there was about this much of it like left in the bottom. And that's about 2 inches for the tape. just realized. And I started accusing everybody of drinking my vodka, because now all of a sudden I've got the fear that there's not enough. You know? And I'm like, what time is it? What time does the liquor store close? You know, and, you know, and everybody's like, Joanne, you know, you can't drive to the liquor store now. You know, you're like, because obviously, while I was in this blackout, I was obviously acting like I was drunk, because I was. And, you know, but I don't remember. Just based on, you know, it's funny, too, about how, as an alcoholic, I learned to judge how drunk I had been by people's reactions to me when I came to. you know, whether it was within that evening or the next day, you know, and I became pretty astute at reading, you know, people's reactions, you know, and I was always trying to second guess, you know, like, you know, as my friend Chris says, you know, I could hear you thinking at me, and it's so true, you know, and I really try to guard against that today. Because I feel that that's, you know, one of my spirit maladies, you know, and it could be, you know, prejudice or, you know, I don't know, self-righteousness or something like that. But back then, I think it was paranoia, you know, that I could hear you thinking at me. But I really couldn't remember that, like, middle 3 inches of that bottle of vodka. And that just proves, like, so clearly to me today, the essence of my disease and how much I'm truly an alcoholic. Because here, after this period of time where I didn't drink at all, and I did it quite successfully, you know, I was doing my job well, I was getting, you know, promotions at my job, and I was moving into another career and doing really well at that. Once again, as I did in school before, I was getting mostly A's and B's. And I successfully moved into that new career. But as soon as I took a drink, that physical allergy, as the doctor's opinion calls it, took over. And the physical allergy for me is that manifestation of the fact that once I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how many drinks I'm going to have. And I say have to have, you know, because there were certain nights when I could go out and I could have two. And I could go home and it would be okay. I'm not saying I was happy about it, okay? But it would be okay. I wouldn't be, like, driven to go out, you know, like, to the next place where those people, you know, usually those people from work, because those were the kinds of people that I had to control myself in front of, you know? Like, but, you know, it's abundantly clear to me now, you know, with what I know from learning from you people here in Alcoholics Anonymous and this beautiful book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that, you know, that was the essence of my disease, was that I had to have more. My body had to have more. And I always just thought that I liked to drink. You know, I thought it was just my personal preference. And once, through my own willpower, I couldn't stop when I wanted to stop. And I couldn't stay stopped when I wanted to stay stopped. I thought I was mentally deficient, morally deficient, that there was something wrong with me. Maybe I'm, like, retarded or something, that I just can't do that, you know, because obviously anything else I wanted to accomplish in my life, I was accomplishing. You know, I was, you know, I was, when you came and got me, I was, you know, married to a successful man. I was driving a Jaguar. I let him have the Jaguar once we got the new Mercedes. And, you know, I mean, we were very successful, you know, on the outside. But inside, I was dying. I hated everybody and everything. And alcohol completely controlled my life. You know, I planned when I was going to drink, how I was going to drink, who I was going to drink with. And alcohol planned for me all these things. Plus, it planned for me what I was going to say and what I was going to think and what my opinions were going to be. You know, and that's so insidious. And it's so hard to understand. You know, and when I was newly sober, I didn't get any of this at all. So for me, you know, the first step... we were powerless over alcohol. The essence of that for me is the fact that I know that even though I am a recovered alcoholic, I am recovered, as our book promises, of that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body where I just couldn't stop once I started and I couldn't stay stopped if I stopped. You know, that was that hopelessness and that not knowing how and not knowing why I couldn't. And not knowing, you know, why me? And what's wrong with me? And not knowing what's wrong with me. And you people explained it to me. And this beautiful book explained it to me. And it's just that, you know, I have something in my body that once I start to drink, I'm not going to stop. And that's why I'm not cured of this. It is a disease, you know? But as long as I don't put the alcohol into my body, I don't set it off. I don't set off that physical part of my disease. Now the question is, of course, how to stay stopped. You know, once I got off the booze. Now I have to tell you, this was not easy for me to get off the booze. After Heather came, was my sister-in-law, came and got her brother. He went into a rehab, and while he was in the rehab, one of my sisters, my eldest sister, said to me, "Joanne, what are you going to do about your drinking?" I said, "What do you mean?" I don't know what you're talking about. She goes, "Well, when's the last time you had a drink?" And I said, "Well, you know, yesterday or last night." I don't remember what my answer was. And she said, "When's the last time you went for a day without having a drink?" I lied. And she said, "When's the last time you went for a week without a drink then?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, everybody's allowed to drink on the weekends. I mean, you know, why not, you know?" And she said, "Well, maybe you need to think about this." And I'm thinking to myself, what the heck is she reading? Where'd she get this from? Who's been talking to her, you know? Because obviously she had gone and gotten some books or something on this thing, and why is she bothering? But what I did was, while he was in the rehab, I stopped drinking. White-knuckled it. Held on by my fingernails, okay? When I went to pick him up from the rehab, we were living in North Jersey. I lived in Jersey from the time I graduated from college until 4 years ago when I bought my home in Pennsylvania. So I did a lot of my drinking career, as I love to call it, was in North Jersey, and South Jersey, and East Jersey, and West Jersey, and New York, and Pennsylvania, and wherever else I traveled. I've been on cruise ships that I don't remember what islands I went to, you know, that kind of thing. But I lost my place. Oh, yes, I went to pick him up at the rehab, thank you. And we were coming to Pennsylvania and to visit some relatives, and he wanted to stop for something to eat. And we stopped at this place that happened to sell booze. And I ordered lunch and an iced tea, and he ordered a glass of wine with his lunch. And I thought to myself, well, I guess there's not so much to this AA thing then, huh? You know, if he's, like, drinking again already. Because here I'm thinking, okay, you know, we're going to fresh start, you know. We're going to be able to, you know, like, settle this thing down a bit and get things under control again. You know, because, like, as, you know, our beautiful book tells us, our lives were really unmanageable emotionally as well as, you know, in our physical world. You know, things were starting to fall apart, you know, and I think that's when the family really started to notice, you know, because they see the outside stuff and we feel the inside stuff, you know, and it was the outside stuff that started to bring attention to it. It was about 10 months later that I was in that rehab, and he was in his, I would say, fourth rehab. That was November of 1992. That was my first sober date, November 22nd, 1992. I went into rehab. I spent Thanksgiving in rehab. I came out, and I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I went to lots of meetings. I did what I was told to do. And I was still dying inside. And my sponsor said, "Well, when you're ready, we'll work the steps." And I was dying inside. Every week. And at this point, you know, I came home from my outpatient the second week and found my husband drunk in the living room. And here I had thought, you know, well, if I go to rehab and he goes to rehab and we come out and we go to AA and everything will be okay and we can stay sober. Well, that wasn't how it worked. And for the next 10 months, that continued to happen. Now, he was very abusive. I don't really need to say a whole lot about that in this venue, other than it was mental and emotional and physical also. I made the decision April of that year to move out. And I found my own place and rented it. I was still working and, you know, getting a nice paycheck. And he went into another rehab and convinced me that this time he was really going to stay sober, and I let him move in with me in about sometime August, September, October of that year. I started drinking. I started experimenting again, as our book calls it, that desperate experiment one more time, because I was dying inside and I didn't have a solution. And I went back to the one that used to work, because I thought that maybe if I just did it, like, you know, I came home on a Friday night and I was so filled with resentment and anger, because once again, you know, he wasn't working, I was working. He sat home and drank all day. I came home, he was usually, you know, maybe in a puddle of something on the, you know, pee on the sofa. I didn't know if I was going to walk in and find him dead or alive most of the time, and I was so filled with fear all the time. Fear of everything and everybody. And I just was continuing to walk through life like I was dead inside. I felt as if I had lost my soul. And I just started to drink one night. And I knew that a little wasn't going to be enough. And I just poured myself a big water glass, threw a couple ice cubes in it, put a splash of orange juice on top of it, and filled a water glass with vodka. I went into a blackout almost immediately, although I think I finished off a good bit of vodka that night. And the next morning I woke up hungover, and, you know, I had not changed. I had not had that vital spiritual experience yet that would change me. And you know what my reaction was? I have such a hangover, we're buying better vodka from now on. You know? What else was I to think? You know, I still had an alcoholic mind. And I drank sporadically for a time. And then the allergy and the mental obsession just took over again, and I was back to drinking every day. I woke up in the morning shaking. I would have to have two. I always swore that I wouldn't drink in the morning. I would have to have two drinks to get me straight. One, I would get down and throw it up, and then the next one would stay down. And that's how I would start my day. And that went on for a period of time until May 10th of 1994. And I called the rehab and I spoke with my counselor and I said, "Alice, I'm drinking." And she said, "Yeah, I heard you were out there. Come on in." And I said, "I can't. I've been drinking. I'm drunk already." And the next morning, I drove myself to Honesty House, which isn't open anymore, I understand, which is kind of sad for me because I used to enjoy going there as an alumni speaker. It was where I got sober, really got sober, because I got there. I pulled over to throw up twice because I had the dry heaves that morning. I got lost on the way there. It's 8 miles from where I was living. I was a mess. You look at me today, I weigh about 150, 55 pounds. I weighed 115 that day. I was really malnourished. Had a lot of physical, you know, problems as a result of what I had done to my body over the last 38 years. But my body has healed itself. But what happened for me then was that first weekend, I was so filled with resentment because I really, really wanted to stay sober this time. And I was sitting in a group of people who were counting how many more days they had left, so when the court would let them out of this place, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, and nobody was really there to get sober, you know. And when Alice got back on Monday morning, you know, I said to her, "I can't believe this. I can't believe the way these people are acting. Blah 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 blah." And she said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I don't want to drink anymore." And she said, "Well, you're here for you. Don't worry about what they're doing. You do what you have to do." And she immediately started me on a written step one. That particular rehab was very program-oriented. You know, and I know Okay, a lot of people say, well, that was rehab. But you know what? I did a full step one. I fully understood the nature of my illness, that it wasn't that I was bad or that I was morally deficient or that I had a lack of willpower, but that I have a disease. I got it, and I accepted it. And I said, all right, I'm going to have to live with it now. What do I do? And I took a full step two, and I said, okay, I don't believe in God. You know, I hated those hypocrites in that church that I was confirmed in. You know, they'd go, you know, and I had all these prejudices against religion. And it was explained to me that this isn't religion, this is spirituality. Spirituality, you can define your own conception of your higher power. And today I call him God because it's the word that's most familiar for me. Okay? It's certainly not the God that I believed in when I was 12 or 4 or 24 or 34, you know? Because I really thought when I was 38 and I walked in there that given all the things that I had done, there was no reason why God wouldn't have turned his back on me and that he had forsaken me, that there was something wrong, so wrong with me that I was irretrievable. And I was brought to step two with the fact that, you know, it wasn't that God had turned his back on me, it was that I had turned my back on him. There's someone that I really love to listen to. Her name is Joyce Meyer. She's a minister, and she does videotapes and tape ministry. One of the things that she says, and I love to say this to my sponsees, is, you know, God calls everybody, but not everybody calls him back, you know? And I had to start calling him back. You know, and to start to pray again and to ask for him to help me not to drink anymore because I was beyond human aid. And that included Ellis. And she told me that. You know, she was that humble. You know, she was sober 17 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she brought me to understand that I could believe in whatever I wanted God to be. And one of the things that, a proposition that she put for me that I think was really helpful for me, and it still works for me today because I believe as a recovered alcoholic, someone who continues to practice these principles, that I need to continue to grow. And she said, if you could think of the best friend you would ever have and what that person would be, let that be your conception of God for now. And see where it goes from there. And that was really a good beginning, you know? And it still works. Because as I start to find out and get past my judgments of my human friends and start to see their good points, my conception of the best friend I could ever have gets bigger, you know? And that continues to work for me. So that was how, you know, I came to believe. And it wasn't all at once. And she convinced me, she said, you know, you don't have to get all of this at once. It's the 12th step that says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, it doesn't say we have to have a spiritual awakening, a full-blown spiritual awakening, before we begin. And that's how I started. And I went forward, and I continued on the program from there. I did my fourth and fifth step before I left that rehab. And what happened was I knew then what my character defects were and what I needed to work towards. Being married to an alcoholic, a lot of the counseling that I got in the rehab, I recognize now as part of the Al-Anon program because I had a lot of very exaggerated low self-esteem, extremely, a lot of self-hatred. I really believed that I was so unacceptable that there was good reason for the way I was treated. I believed that the way that my alcoholism had manifested in my life was a punishment from God. And that was really scary at the beginning. And to get past that in the second step was my hurdle. I know other people have different hurdles. And as I work with more and more women, actually, one of the great things about here in a fifth step is I learn a lot about me. you know, that of course is like the real thing, you know. But as we have our little, you know, our little spiritual awakenings along the way, you know, as we begin to take someone who's new to us, as a sponsee or a protege, as I like to call them, I learn so much about me, and it makes me think, makes me revisit all my steps again and think, I never quite looked at it that way. You know, you're right about that. Hey, you know, you got a point. And that's one of the beautiful things about working with others. And I think that's one of the reasons why it keeps it so fresh for us. And it says it's of vital importance, vital meaning life-giving, that we continue to work with others. You know, I know the last couple seminars have been, like last Saturday, have been about sponsorship. So, notice in my speaking lately, I've been talking a bit more about that because I think it's important for us to teach others our experience with sponsorship also, as well as what happened to us as we work the steps, but also what happens when we're working with others. Because each time I come up with a new woman, you know, it's a totally new thing, you know. And I go through that a little bit of that spirit malady, like, because I always run back to, is she going to like me? You know, that's where I run, you know. And that's because that's, for me, that's really the core of my spirit malady is, you know, is she going to like me? You know, and I sit down and I'm a little bit, you know, sometimes a little tentative about how strongly I put forward, you know, what we're going to do. But that's where I run. But the essence of step two for me, back to the program, as we're supposed to do it tonight, the essence of step two for me really was not so much, you know, there's a page in there that says, you know, we had to ask ourselves, is God everything or is he nothing? What was our choice to be? And for me, that was a little too strong when I started, because I really couldn't answer that he was everything, honestly, at that point when I was that new and that green and that raw and that scared. But you know what I knew? I had some hope. I had some hope that if I tried this thing, you know, it might work for me too. Because everything I had tried up to that point didn't work. No matter what I did, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stay stopped. You know, and that was the problem, was I couldn't stay stopped. You know, even if I could stay stopped for a day, what happened the next day? You know, and that, you know, constantly wondering and worrying and thinking, you know, where, what, where, when, what am I going to do? You know, and how could I enjoy my life without it? You know, that was pretty scary. But you told me that I could, and it would work, if I just gave it a good go. So I did. And I've been sober ever since, so I guess it's working. Thanks for letting me share.